The first time I heard that hymn, I was sitting in the pew with a longtime friend. We were in that strange space that follows a reckoning of sorts. I'd hurt her, damaged our relationship. And while I wanted badly to understand and fix things, I felt helpless to succeed at doing either. But there we were, both at church that morning, and we sat next to each other, kind of awkwardly. And as we sang this hymn with its sweet, mournful minor key, I was instantly filled with this deep, haunted yen for it. The tune, the tone, the words, all of it captured what I was feeling that morning, what I felt way too often, in fact. Shame, failure, misery. A deep and certain sense that I was wretched and wrong and unfit for friendship of any kind, let alone the kind of friendships I wanted to cultivate that involved trust and openness and selfless kindness. These sorry things within overwhelmed me. My hands were full of them as if I were carrying a heavy box. If only I could just lay these burdens down, the song said. The cool thing was, when the song ended, I looked at my friend and we had this mutual moment of wow. I don't know if it made her think of the awkwardness between us too, but it did me, and for a second it smoothed things over a little. She scribbled down the title, I made a beeline to the piano afterwards to beg for the sheet music, and I spent the next couple weeks plunking out the tune at home, humming it in my head at work, memorizing the words. How could I find that peace, Christ's peace, that the song spoke of? How could I just get out of its way for once, forgive myself for all my wretched humanity, and maybe finally somehow even let that peace inside me? On Monday evenings, I have a class at CSU. It's a workshop class, which I take every semester as I pursue an MA in creative nonfiction writing. What's that, most people ask, smirking. I guess because creative nonfiction can sound a little tongue-in-cheek, like alternative facts, playing fast and loose with the truth. But actually, I think of it as anything but that. It's stuff like personal essay, memoir, like the kind of indescribable, not really self-help, sometimes spiritual, always life-giving stuff written by people like Liz Gilbert and Anne Lamott and Deepak Chopra and our old friend Brené Brown. In fact, what I've written for you this morning is creative nonfiction. So I tend to see it as a pursuit of the truth, cracking life open to get at the truth the way a dog cracks open the dead matter of a bone to get at the good hearty marrow inside. It's a search for the capital T truth that lets you make capital M meaning out of the experiences of your life, which if you're into writing too, kind of tends to lead to places like graduate programs in creative nonfiction writing. And one thing I've learned 30 credits in is that no one comes to a program like this without having found that kind of meaning by way of going through some stuff. And while it's true that everyone's been through some stuff, the people who seek out this program have hit the point where they want to share their stuff. So here's how workshop works. Every week, a couple of people in the class pass out a piece of their writing, usually 12 to 15 pages. And the rest of us spend the week reading it, marking it up with suggestions, commenting on what we loved, and marveling at just how wrong we can be in our assumptions about one another's inner lives and landscapes. Because y'all, in this class, people are sharing some serious stuff. The topics vary widely, but they are never easy things. Death features prominently, of parents, siblings, of close friends, lovers, sometimes of children, addiction, sexual assault, trauma of all kinds, suicide attempts, disordered eating, body dysmorphia, gender dysphoria, divorce, infidelity, anxieties of all stripes, religious trauma, life-threatening diagnosis, wartime service, abuse. Sometimes it's stuff that's been handed to them, stuff that's happened to them. Sometimes it's stuff that's come about due to their own actions, recklessness, stupidity, weakness, loneliness, brokenness. And the worst kind of stuff is the stuff they put out there into the world themselves, stuff they failed at, stuff that plagues them, stuff they blame themselves for, stuff they can't let go of, can't forgive themselves for, stuff they can't lay down. Trust me, nobody's there to write about how smooth life has gone for them. And when someone's new to the program and you wonder what their stuff is, you kind of have to wait to find out. You'll know soon enough once it's their turn to submit their writing, because there is this unspoken rule that you do not just go up to a new member of the program and ask what their material is about. No one wants to answer that question aloud. It's hard enough to put it out there in writing, because it's all stuff. It may not be the same as your stuff. Maybe not be the stuff that you expected, but it never fails. It's always some pretty heavy stuff. Why do we do it? My parents' generation said that you don't air your dirty laundry in public. You don't let people see your stuff. No, you cultivate a facade. Make it seem like everything's okay, like you've got it all under control. Which always seemed to me to be a pretty lonely existence. Because some people are really good at that, coming off as though everything's perfect. But there's nothing about being perfect to which I can relate. Nothing to which I can say, yeah, me too. There's no community in perfection. It's isolating. It makes me want to isolate myself. There's nothing connective there. The hardest part of workshop is the week that passes between dropping your piece of writing with all of your stuff and everyone coming back to talk about it in class the next week. If you get to class a few minutes early, everyone's standing around just chatting before we begin, and there's this sick, panicky feeling. Brené Brown called it the vulnerability hangover, that everyone now knows your stuff. And what on earth do they think of you now? You're hyper aware. Are they looking at you differently? Are they being extra sticky nice, avoiding you, feigning nonchalance? Do they judge you? Do they accept you? Did you share too much? Should you just have written about something nice and easy and relatable, like how sad you were when you were 9 and your childhood dog died? It's terrifying. And the only thing that makes it possible to do it is that everybody's doing it. So it forms this kind of community. Communion is supposed to be something connective, something we do together. It's in the word itself, coming together to be one, but it doesn't always feel that way to me. Maybe I just don't get it. Like prayer, like baptism, communion can feel very much like something one is doing alone. I have never felt in taking the bread and the cup any real connection to the people around me. The fact that they are all doing the same thing as me seems incidental. I don't necessarily know anything about what their stuff is, and they don't necessarily know mine, and while it's nice that we're all participating in the same ritual at the same time, there's nothing really all that connective about it for me. But I know there was something connective in that first communion. It's there in the words of institution. We remember that on the night of desertion and betrayal, Christ gathered with his followers in the upper room. They had gathered for a meal together, for companionship, and for sustenance, with those they considered brethren, with a man each considered to be his teacher. I imagine this table full of jostling and laughter and conversation, reaching across one another for food, all these small conversations in twos and threes, occasionally coalescing into larger discussions, perhaps even plans being made for the future. And then suddenly, in the middle of all that, Christ gets up, takes off his outer robe, takes up a towel, a bowl, a pitcher, kneels at the dirty, dusty, smelly feet of one of his disciples and begins to wash his feet. And I imagine the convivial spirit of the supper evaporating into surprise, into shock, as they realized what he was doing. I mean, in Christ's time, a servant, perhaps even a slave, washed the filth and the road dirt from a guest's feet, never the host himself. And never someone in a position of power. That would mean breaking through a social stigma. Feet were such an unclean part of the body, the climate there so hot and sweaty and dusty, the sandals so filthy. And lowering yourself and performing a service you surely did not want to perform, especially during the business of a meal, all in order to increase your guest's comfort. And when Peter objected, did you hear what Christ said to Peter? I mean, you said it just a few minutes ago. Unless I wash you, your feet, your uncleanliness, your filth away, you have no share with me. Other translations of that phrase, you are not one of my people. You will no longer be my disciple. You can't be part of what I'm doing. He says, unless you let me wash your feet, you're not part of this thing I'm doing. In workshop, we all share our stuff. It's kind of impossible to connect with anyone if you don't. I mean, didn't Brené Brown say that vulnerability is the first thing I want to see from you, but the last thing I want you to see in me? Well, I learned pretty quickly you can't connect without sharing your stuff. The first time I submitted something, it was a piece about the Camino, about the blisters I got along the way, days of walking cross country in hiking boots under a 30-pound pack. I talked about those blisters, man, I'll tell you, how they formed, how they hurt, how I treated mine, how others treated theirs, how sometimes folks got left behind when their blisters were bad, and you had to learn to be okay with that. But I never said a thing about blisters on a capital T truth scale. I never talked about the capital M meaning of treating your blisters. I didn't talk about the times in my capital L life when I'd left people behind because I didn't want to wait while they dealt with their capital B blisters. And I didn't talk about how much it hurt to sit on the side of the trail in my own life alone and in pain in the times that I've been forsaken. I kept it on a surface level, nice and safe. I was too scared to talk about those deeper things, my own brokenness. It was so much easier just to sit back and take in all my classmates' stories, all their stuff, all their shame that they had trusted me with. But that wasn't the deal, and I found myself an outsider. I watched bonds form between those who shared their toughest stuff, and I longed for that courage, that connection. So much has been made of the bread and the cup, and rightly so, because we're told that the mystery of faith is found within, but this thing with the bowl and the water? Well, if you've ever participated in a foot washing, you get it. How intimate a thing it is, how humble, how connective. Because it's an all-in thing. It takes both hands. You roll up your sleeves and you are in it. You strip off your shoes and then your socks and let someone hold your dusty, sweaty feet in their hands. Or maybe first you did this for another person, felt the grace and tenderness of that task, held their feet and thought about your own and how yours were no better and realized that someone was about to do the same for you and prayed for that grace and tenderness in return. And you got it. Well, I'm not sure I really get this with communion. But when I think about how John juxtaposed this scene of Christ washing the disciples' feet with that of the Last Supper, I think maybe I start to get it. Because maybe communion's supposed to be like that. Maybe it's supposed to be communal in that we've all shown up here with our hands full of our own stuff, that we all know what it's like to buckle under the weight of the stuff that we blame ourselves for, the stuff we just can't lay down. Your stuff may not be the same as my stuff, but geez, don't we all know what it's like to feel intensely and wretchedly and hopelessly ashamed of our stuff. But the thing is, like foot washing, taking communion is a two-handed business. If you don't believe me, watch a Dexter kid take communion sometime. He pins down the loaf with one hand while peeling off a good long strip, good for two or three mouthfuls. You can't have anything else in your hands when you go up to receive the body of Christ like that. And I like that about our communion, that it's an active thing, that you come forward for it, that you tear off your own piece, and it's always so little. It's always the little tiny bit that we think we deserve. It's always so much less than what we really want and what we really feel we need. When I first came to this church, I liked how we once did it, passing the platters carefully along the pews, serving one another, your neighbor holding it steady for you before you turned to do the same for the next person. I mean, that took at least two hands, more like four. Even as a child, with the Episcopalians waiting to receive from the Father the little wafer we affectionately, if irreverently, called the Jesus, I was taught to come forward, my hands empty, open, receptive, one palm in the other, waiting, open. It takes two hands. And you know what that means? Whatever else you're holding, whatever guilt or shame you are carrying through this life, whatever you think you've done so wrong that you don't deserve this grace, you gotta lay that stuff down first. Because if bread is grace, we all need both hands to take hold of it. The sharing of the bread and the cup came down to us through the ages, and we do it every week, but that's not all Christ did that night at the table. And I wonder, what if Christ meant, along with partaking of his life and his love in the bread and the cup, what if he also meant for us to take each other's feet into our hands, each other's shame and isolation and brokenness, and wash the dirt and dust of that lonely road away, to serve one another in this difficult and intimate and holy way? What if he meant for us to get up close and personal with each other's stuff, trusting each other with it, creating space for one another to be imperfect? I want communion to feel like that. Communion is grace. I want to take communion like the Alberts do, all together at once with the people I love, each of them waiting for the others to be served so that all share in this abundant grace at once, or none of us do. I want to take communion like a Dexter kid, peeling those long strips off the bread, and chomping away, utterly unselfconscious, secure in the knowledge that it's there for me anyway, that God doesn't mind because he adores me anyway, that there's always more than enough for anyone anyway. And then if I worry, if I didn't quite get enough, I can sneak into room one after the service and get me just a little bit more, because don't the good Lord know just how bad we all need a little more grace. Once I did finally share some stuff in workshop, I was blown away by the response. I was gathered in. My classmates each opened their two hands and brought me in. Some hugged me, told me I've been brave, made space for my brokenness with their own. Everyone thinks their stuff is the worst. It almost never is. Besides, the saying goes that if we all got in a circle and piled all our stuff in the center and saw what everyone else's stuff was, we'd grab our stuff back. When Christ got done washing the feet of his disciples, he told them to do the same for others. You said it. He said, if you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. We do know. It's right there in the red letters. So now it's our job to do. It's our job to help each other carry our stuff. And it's our job to help each other lay down the stuff when it's time to receive some grace. It's our job to find folks we can share our stuff with, and by doing so, let them share theirs with us. Because when you see their stuff and they see yours, theirs might be different stuff, but it's still stuff, and it still shames them. And once we start talking about shame, it becomes clear real fast that we're not all that different. The Me Toos start happening. The connections start forming. You look around and find that No one's looking at you any different after all. And if they are, it's with gratitude that you made space for them to be imperfect. It's with wonder at what you've been carrying all this time. It's with compassion over how hard this road we're walking on can be. And we're not alone. We walk it together. And that is grace. That is communion. Amen.